Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dr. Lawyer, idiot chief. For my life with songs of grief, with the yellow fear and fear the size. Temper all the times, the times
I work. Two Dudes Perspective on Legal Frivolic. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer, dude, and a judge.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am still just a dude.
Well, I didn't forget that I was a judge this time because we actually had court where I sat on the bench. It's been a while, but I was back on the bench.
And, you know, I always have a bad connotation with that because being on the bench means you're not playing. I always, you know, I hate being on the bench. I'll put me in, coach. I'm ready to go.
Yeah, I think it's kind of funny because I think I am definitely one of those judges that likes to ask questions. Some judges, they'll let the attorneys ask all the questions. They never say a word. They just kind of listen to what's said, and then they make a ruling. Not me. I'm constantly asking questions.
Well, that's probably good. I mean, especially if you're the one making the decision. If there's a jury, I don't know. You know, you probably don't do it as much if there's a jury, huh?
You can do it when there's a jury, but you have to be a bit more judicious with your judicial questions.
Well, as a judge, you should be very judicious.
Well, you don't want to say anything that's going to possibly influence the jury one way or the other.
Right.
If there's no jury present, you're just taking evidence through witness testimony, there's no jury, you're just making a decision on it, you can ask whatever you want because it doesn't really matter.
But right.
If you're the judge asking questions from the bench with a jury, you have to be kind of cautious because you might be opening the door for something you shouldn't be doing. So,
yeah, or you may be deemed helping out one side or the other or something like that.
Oh, there's judges that do that. There certainly are.
Well, you wouldn't want to be deemed one of those judges, though.
It's always fun whenever, you know, you're the criminal defense attorney and there's a prosecutor on the table across from you and there's a prosecutor sitting on the bench in front of you, too.
Yeah.
It's not fun.
Yeah, it's like when the referees are rooting for the other team, too, and you're playing against seven guys on the other team instead of five.
Yeah, that's not a good thing. Mm. The best you can hope for is referees that are just incompetent.
Yeah, and they're incompetent for everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not up for some sort of nefarious purpose. They're just bad.
Yeah, as long as they're consistently incompetent, it's okay.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. Well, we're all playing with the same ball here, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah. As long as you call the fouls the same way both ways, or don't call them the same way both ways.
Well, as a, I guess, kind of a housekeeping note, we're back to recording remotely again.
Yeah, not for corona reasons.
No quarantine going on here.
Just convenience. You were at home.
I was at home. I said, hey, rather than drive over there, how about we just go ahead and start? And, okay.
So now, as they have said in for current society now, the new normal, as they call it, that's probably a lot of things that they're going to do as far as people working from home. They're going to figure out, you know what? We don't have to have all these people in the office. Maybe we don't need as big an office. And then things I read, they're not going to figure out they don't need as many people. What some of these guys figured out is who were the ones that really do the work. And so some of the others, they're going to get to stay home for good, but they won't be getting a check.
Congratulations. You have just shown you are non-essential.
That's right.
I actually had my first deposition via Zoom today.
Yeah.
Zoom is kind of like that Skype app that some people use.
Right.
And I did it from home. I was in my office this morning. I thought, you know what? I can do this deposition from anywhere. We're doing it via Zoom, so I might as well just go home and do it.
Sure.
So I was actually planning on doing it outside. There was video, so you could see me, and there was a tree in my background, everything like that. And the court reporter mentioned, "Oh, it looks like you're in a nice setting." And I said, yep, I've never had a deposition where I got to sit outside. And I said, I'm going to give it a try today and just check that off the old to-do list. And so sure enough, 3 o'clock, the appointed time we're about to start, rolls around. We get ready to start the deposition. There goes my neighbor firing up the lawnmower.
You should have told him, shut that thing down. I got a deposition to going on here.
We got court going on over here. What are you doing?
What the hell's wrong with you? You're interfering with the wheels of justice.
So I had to pick up my mobile deposition unit and walk inside to the office and do it from there.
Well, you learned a valuable lesson.
What's that?
That when you're at home, there's other people in the neighborhood doing things far more valuable than your job.
That's true.
Yeah, it was time to cut their grass.
This neighbor cuts his grass probably 3 to 4 times a week, I think.
Yeah, my dad does that. He loves cutting grass.
Oh, your dad's yard looks really nice.
Oh, yeah, it does.
It looks nicer than my neighbor's.
Yeah, his grass is so thick and green and lush, you could sleep on it.
Yeah, absolutely. I one day hope to attain a lawn like Dan Smurl.
Mine is a finely manicured row of weeds.
If it's green, it doesn't matter, right?
That's right. I just spray painted some of it.
Nothing wrong with that.
As long as it looks green, neighbors will quit complaining.
Oh, I don't think your neighbors would complain.
They did before I got my grass in.
Did they?
Guy said, do you have anybody putting grass in yet? I said, no, I can't find anybody to do it. He said, here's my card. Call this person. He does my yard. He'll take care of yours.
And that's the guy that came over and threw down the weeds?
Yeah. Yeah, he said, you're not going to get any grass to grow here, but I can get something green to grow. I said, okay.
Sounds good.
Yeah. It's got my lucky didn't plant my yard with marijuana, huh?
Yeah.
That's green as far as I know.
That's a cash crop these days.
Yeah.
They just passed a law here in Putnam County, one county over, that they're okayed to grow it, to dispense it, and to, I guess, process it. I really don't know what goes into the whole processing of marijuana, but maybe that's to do with like making edibles and things like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know anything about the business, and I wouldn't admit to it if I did.
That's a growth industry.
That's true.
All right. Well, you suggested a topic this week, and it was one that I had never heard of before.
Yeah. Well, I came across an article, and it really caught my attention. And part of it is because I'd never heard of this person either. And then once I started looking at the history, I've seen some movies that she was in, but I didn't remember the name, and I certainly didn't remember this incident. And she died in 1979. So I was a year married by then, so it's not like I was a kid and wouldn't remember.
Yeah.
Even though I got married as a kid, but still.
So I'll let you take the lead about how you want to tell this story.
Well, I think that we should start with the impetus that got this whole thing started, and that goes back to the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover.
A lot of good stories go back that way.
J. Edgar Hoover was... I don't know if you'd exactly call him a good guy, even though he was the head of the FBI. He used his powers in the FBI, which at the time were kind of omnipotent. He used them to do whatever he wanted and to undermine people and to create problems for him if he thought that they were a problem.
I think back then it was a bit of an unfair playing field, too, because I think the FBI, technology-wise, was leaps and bounds ahead of your average U.S. citizen. And they were much more tech savvy. They had the ability to communicate. And citizens didn't have the internet, which allows people to kind of get together and figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
So I think back then it was probably like bringing a machine gun to a knife fight to a certain degree.
Well, I mean, if they decided that there was something wrong with what you did or they didn't like something you said, they would wiretap you. I mean, they'd go in and put bugs in your phone, and they didn't need a warrant or a search warrant or anything like that. They just went in and did it.
Yeah. And since then, that's been determined to be highly frowned upon.
Yeah, I would hope so. But he was a peculiar character. In some of his own personal habits, this didn't really come out. I'm sure that it was rumored and there's whispered about, but it didn't come out till after his death. But he was a cross-dresser that enjoyed cross-dressing and going out into society in this way. And I think there were people that knew about it, but nobody said anything because he'd probably have them killed. And it's not right. that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, if somebody wants to do that, that's fine. But he was a hypocrite because he would then have investigations on other people and ruin their lives by making this public if he found out about other people doing those kind of things.
Right.
So he was a real hypocrite about it. He led a kind of, at that time, what was considered a deviant lifestyle, but he was reporting others that were leading a lifestyle that way.
And that's the real problem. Not the lifestyle he led, but the fact that he led that lifestyle and then used his position to harm other people who were living the same lifestyle.
Exactly.
That is not, that is a, I think if you actually looked up hypocrisy in the dictionary, that would be a picture or a definition of it.
Yeah. So, and it was all kinds of people. He seemed to really like the rich and famous. He had,
if your dictionary has pictures in it.
Yeah.
Mine doesn't.
Sometimes they do, but they're usually drawings. They're not pictures. They're drawings.
Drawings.
Bud Abbott and Lou Costello were perhaps best known for their comedy sketch, Who's On First?
Yeah, but I love them.
But in the 1950s, the duo caught the FBI's attention for other reasons. A police informant furnished information to the effect that Bud Abbott, the well-known motion picture and television star, is a collector of pornography and alleged that he has 1,500 reels of obscene motion pictures, an agent wrote in an FBI file. So back then it was 8mm reels of film or something like that that they had. You know, they weren't on video or CDs or anything.
So Bud Abbott was the connoisseur of porn?
And then of Costello, agents reported, information was secured reflecting that two prostitutes put on a lewd performance for Lou Costello for which they were paid $50 each. So
it's like going to a strip club, basically, it sounds like.
I don't know. Well, but I mean, that they kept these files and followed these people around and gathered this information.
And just so we're clear, this is what the article said, called them prostitutes.
Yeah.
We refer to them as sex workers.
Correct. But that was the quote from the report that was in there. That was the language of that time. They had reports on like Anna Nicole Smith, because she had been threatened with extortion or violence. They had others like writer Norman Mailer or actor Charlie Chaplin. They were suspected of being communist sympathizers. And then John Lennon was on the list. He was watched for his involvement in anti-war politics.
When you say Anna Nicole Smith, are you referring to the woman who was kind of recent?
Yeah, the Playboy playmate that then died later. Mm-hmm. And they had the big custody hearing over the little girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one.
I was just wondering because it seemed like a lot of those characters were a bit more older, and then you had her. So I didn't know if she was named after someone different.
No, that was her. Hmm. During the era of the legendary FBI director J. Edgar Hoover, you could find a reason to open a file on anyone. The reasons for the surveillance are as varied as the people being watched. Official government files on the rich and famous is very dependent on the character or the situation the subject of the file was in. Today, the Bureau's Cold War era fears of communist infiltration, obscenity, and homosexuality sound almost quaint. The early rock and roll song Louie Louie by the Kingsmen, remember that? For instance, it was the subject of a 119-page file. The lyrics, written in a quasi-Caribbean meter, are famously difficult to discern. Some, including an official at a Florida high school and Indiana Governor Matthew Welsh, suspected the words were secretly obscene, and the FBI launched an investigation. The laboratory is requested to determine if enclosed record Louie Louie can be considered obscene for purposes of prosecution, an agent wrote in the file. Said, you had this very bizarre situation, the nation's leading crime-fighting service, tapping their toes, listening to Louie Louie. The Bureau's agents famously kept tabs on entertainment and political figures suspected of communist ties. In the Hoover period, people were investigated under suspicion of disloyalty, said John Wiener, a historian at the University of California and author of a book on FBI's investigation of John Lennon. Now, we consider this abuse of power. Lenin, for instance, was feared for his influence in the anti-Vietnam War movement and was watched for years.
Now, the one program that you were talking about, it started in 1956. Mm-hmm. And this is called COINTELPRO, which stands for Counterintelligence Program, kind of a syllabic portmanteau, if you will. I think that's the proper way to describe it.
Kathmandu.
Kathmandu. But Hoover had sent a letter denouncing Dr. T.R.M. Howard, who was a civil rights leader and a surgeon and a wealthy entrepreneur in Mississippi, who had been very critical of the FBI during their inaction during the recent murders of George W. Lee and Emmett Till.
Mm-hmm.
We had spoken about Emmett Till before.
Right.
He was the 14-year-old African-American who was lynched after he was accused of offending a young white girl at her family's grocery store in 1955.
Mm-hmm.
And evidently, Dr. T.R.M. Howard was very critical of the FBI and their kind of lack of involvement and help in trying to solve that. And based upon that, they decided, you know what, we're going to open up a file on you for being critical of us for not doing something.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you didn't want to make him an enemy because it didn't take much. And when he opened up a file, if they were going to spend the time opening a file, they were going to find something.
Yeah. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the SCLC, was a African-American civil rights organization, was founded in 1957. And the FBI started monitoring Martin Luther King and some other people that were involved in that. And it's historically very clear that Hoover had something out for Martin Luther King. They started bugging his home and his hotel rooms. They were very aware that he was kind of growing in stature and having a lot of influence in the country. And he actually started becoming very critical of them as well for what they were doing, because he became aware of how they were following him and keeping tabs on him too.
Mm-hmm.
So during this period, the late 50s, early 60s is when this all kind of really started to come to a head.
They had files on Marilyn Monroe and her being linked to the Kennedys. And she was married to Arthur Miller, who they were suspecting he was a communist sympathizer. Other pop culture figures, Frank Sinatra, for example, was rumored to have mob ties, and his son was once kidnapped at gunpoint. And the Bureau compiled a relatively brief 34-page file on guitarist Jimi Hendrix, following his arrest in 1969 by Toronto police on drug charges. If he is found innocent of the charge, Canadian immigration would like to deport him anyway to the U.S. if he can be shown he has prior criminal convictions, the agent wrote. So the FBI's file included information about the guitarist's criminal history, including an arrest in 1961 for driving a car without the owner's permission.
Now, there's one crazy thing that the FBI is alleged to have done with regard to Martin Luther King that I want to talk about, and it blew my mind.
Yeah.
But before we get to that, I think there's actually a motion that we have.
Why, yes, we have a sponsor that is back with us again that we have had previously, and we're glad to have him back. So we'd like to approach the bench to pay court costs and present Lightstream.
So that's who we have on the docket. You jumped my line.
Oh, who do we have on the docket?
We have Lightstream.
Oh, we reversed.
Go ahead, Your Excellency. You from your throne.
Why? Thank you, peon. If you're like many of us, you carry a balance on your credit cards, and if those cards come with a high interest rate, you need to check out Lightstream.
Lightstream can help you lower your interest rate and save money with a credit card consolidation loan.
Quickly roll balances from multiple credit cards into one single monthly loan payment.
And you can get a rate as low as 5.95 APR with AutoPay and no fees.
The application is 100% online. You don't have to leave home to apply.
And that's the nice thing. You can be sitting at your home, go ahead and apply. No need to go down to a bank or anything like that. And you can actually even get your money as soon as the day as you apply.
Because Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience. And that's exactly what they deliver.
The thing about credit cards is the interest rates on credit cards can be very, very high. And if you're just making the minimum payments, you're actually never going to get caught up. You're essentially just paying the interest. So you got to figure out some way to make some headway into it.
Yeah, and I've looked at times before where I said, I wish that if I believed what these people said, I would want to do that and consolidate my credit cards and get that single payment and make some headway on these things. But you never know who to trust. And that's where Lightstream comes in. They're banked, or they're backed by a legitimate bank in Florida, SunTrust.
SunTrust.
Right?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And it's an actual bank.
Yeah. And it's somebody that you can depend on. And so you could go to them worry free.
And our listeners that apply right now are able to get an additional interest rate discount to save even more.
The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/courtappointed.
That's lightstream.com/courtappointed for an additional discount.
LIGHTSTREAM.com/courtappointed. Subject to credit approval. Rate includes 0.50% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/courtappointed for more information.
That was a very good
radio voice.
Radio voice. I like that.
Well, I've got a face for radio, so I thought I'd try a voice for one.
You got a face for podcasting.
I was emulating my hero, Clint McElroy, and his many years of DJing.
He does have a very distinctive radio voice.
Oh, yeah. You always know it's Clint when you hear him.
He's not on the radio anymore at all now, is he?
Oh, no. He retired from that.
I knew he retired, but does he still do some advertising every now and then?
There's still some ads running with his voice on it, but yeah. I don't think he does any of that. They're too busy touring and doing all that stuff.
When I still had my own law firm, we had talked about maybe having Clint do a radio spot for us with his distinct Clint McElroy voice.
Yeah.
If you need a lawyer, go see Michael Meadows.
That sounded pretty good. You could do your own.
Well, now the one interesting story that I read about the FBI and Martin Luther King, and I have not adequately fact-checked this, so this is just out there on the internet. This could be totally bogus, and it's so crazy you would almost think it has to be, but I don't know that it is. Evidently, during their following Martin Luther King around and wiretapping him and all these things, they discovered that Dr. King may have been having an affair or had some indiscretions or something along those lines. And so they allegedly sent tapes of him, like proof, basically, of this affair or whatever was going on to him with a note that said, if he did not do the honorable thing and end his life, that they were going to release it and it would destroy his entire movement that he had worked so hard to build.
Mm-hmm.
And so evidently, obviously he did not do that, but he basically put out there that they had sent that letter to him and all this was going on. Hmm. So I can't even believe that is what our government was actually doing at that point. It blows my mind.
Well, I've never heard that, but I'll say there's nothing that could have come out of J. Edgar Hoover's FBI that would surprise me. There have been so many stories of wrongdoing and abuse that nothing that comes out of that would surprise me.
Now, I have a bit of a story about how a lot of this came to light, and I wanted to get into that, but did you want to talk about the one lady that you were referring to before we talk about the downfall of it and the expose?
Yeah, the article that I came across was a story about an actress from 1950s and 60s Hollywood, mostly. Her name was Jean Seberg.
Never heard of her.
I didn't either, but she was in a movie with Clint Eastwood.
Really?
Yeah. Paint Your Wagon. It was a musical, actually. And she was in that with him, and I've seen the movie, but I just didn't really know the name, I guess, because I didn't think I'd ever heard of her or seen her. But they had the biggest talent search for a Hollywood film in the 1950s. More than 18,000 unknown actresses from the United States and Europe auditioned, but a pretty 17-year-old girl from Marshalltown, Iowa, won the chance to play Joan of Arc in Otto Preminger's 1957 film, St. Joan. Now, Otto Preminger was a big, famous director that only did big, grand movies.
Yeah, I've heard the name before.
It had the largest soundstage in Europe, 1,500 extras, and glittering premieres in France, England, and America. But critics panned the movie. The media treated Jean Seberg's portrayal of the French martyr so viciously that many assumed she would return to her quiet life in Iowa as soon as possible. But the actress persevered to become an important figure in the development of modern cinema and the face of mod fashion. Now, while she didn't get a lot of offers for American movies, she got a lot in the French. For some reason, the French really took to her. So she started making films over there.
Kind of like how David Hasselhoff was huge in Germany.
Yeah, that's right. Don't know why, but it just happened. She made a movie in France. It's called a new wave film that was called Breathless. And it rejected big budgets and formal techniques for something more raw. While too risque for Marshalltown, the French adored it and clamored for more of Seberg. So she went on. She had this pixie-cut short hair and kind of like Twiggy from that era, the model Twiggy. I don't know if you're familiar with her.
I am familiar.
But she had the real short pixie-cut hair, and so she could wear the fashions of the 60s, you know, if you've seen those before and things like that. And so the French really took to her. Well, somewhere along the line there, she was married. She was with her second husband, and she had an affair with a fella that was a Black Panther. Now, the Black Panthers were an African-American group that scared J. Edgar Hoover to death. So he wanted to do anything he could do to undermine them. Seberg was not only having an affair, but she was openly donating money to them and saying, you know, what a good community action group they were, which the things that you heard about, I mean, I remember as a kid hearing about the Black Panthers, but now when I see documentaries about how they really operated, that was a legitimate group that was benefiting, you know, Black society.
Yeah.
And white America did not want them to succeed, and they scared white America, and white America did away with them. And so they didn't want anybody lending any credibility to them. So they decided they were going to discredit this actress so that no one would follow that example, because you know how sometimes Hollywood does things and they start championing things and people join in and it makes them legitimate.
Right. Because they have a large voice. They have a lot of influence. People see them. They're recognizable.
Right.
Yeah.
So J. Edgar Hoover saw that as a threat and he wanted to end that. So he got the rumor started. She was pregnant with a child with her second husband, and he had an agent release a rumor they knew was false to a L.A. gossip columnist, and he put it out that she was pregnant with the baby of the Black Panther member that she was having the affair with.
Right.
So of course this caused in that time era, this caused a lot of, you know, concern and backlash and everything else. And she said that it caused her so much anxiety. She had the baby two months early and it ended up dying. Mm-hmm. She of course denied that it was. And so, I mean, they even did like an open casket at the funeral so people could see the paternity of the baby.
Yeah.
To discredit what people were saying about her.
It's a shame she would have to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. To put her through that. But she was never the same after that. She became an alcoholic. You know, her film career didn't go anywhere. And so, few years later, they basically find her dead, rolled up in a rug in the back of her car in Paris.
Yeah.
So it was very sad what happened to her. And this was all because she became a target of J. Edgar Hoover because she backed a movement like the Black Panthers.
So, yeah, they released this rumor and essentially destroyed this woman's life.
Yeah, because in those days, that kind of a rumor didn't go over well.
No. I mean, it's similar to how we are in this day and age. If you released a rumor saying that you were intolerant of people or something along those lines, it could almost go in the other direction.
Right.
I mean, that's people don't, we've come full circle now at this point. So it's, you know, if you are intolerant of people or a racist or things like that, then that would actually ruin your career. I mean, you see it happen all the time.
You know, and you say that the government wouldn't do anything like that now. You would hope that they don't still do that. But then you have the situation like where Trump keeps tweeting about how that Joe Scarborough that's on the talk show or whatever it is, the news reporter or whatever he is, and he keeps talking about him having something to do with the murder of a girl that was his staffer when he used to be in Congress. And not only is he putting something false out there just to cause problems for him, but the girl's family has asked time and time again for him to stop that, that it just causes them all kinds of extra pain in reliving it and everything.
Oh, yeah, he doesn't care.
No, he doesn't care.
And his most of the things that he does, they are they're right on the border of being actionable, I think. Like he pushes right up to the line and then stops.
Yeah, but here's one of the differences, I think, in that day and time when the FBI accused Gene Seberg of this, there wasn't any way to get your word back out there. I mean, the press was very limited. It was local. You couldn't go to a TV station and they were going to put you on or anything like that. There was no such thing as Twitter or Instagram or Facebook or anything that you could post things out there. You couldn't get your word out there. You were at the mercy of the press. And if they put something out and they all jumped on it because it sold papers, they were just going to keep going with it. And there was nothing you could do. And your side of the story would never be heard.
That's what I was kind of getting at a little bit earlier in the episode when we were talking about, I was talking about technology and how it's kind of leveled the playing field to a certain degree, because we're so interconnected now with the internet and Twitter and different things like that, that it's harder for government agencies to get away with things like that now, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's also people have an ability to fight back now because of that, whereas you don't before. Yeah. And I also think that we're not as afraid of our government as we were then.
That's true. I still think you have to be afraid of our government because they're scary. But
what I mean is, if we feel that something is being done that's wrong, we're willing to stand up to it. I think there was, for a long time, I mean, like, you know, when in my parents' era, they, even if the government was wrong, that's the government. You don't stand up to them, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think that happened very often.
Yeah. You got to fight the man.
That's right.
So you got to ask yourself, you know, is the FBI directly related to what happened to her?
Absolutely.
I'd say so, but that's hard to kind of piece it together, legally speaking, I think, from an evidentiary standpoint. I mean, I think a reasonable person can piece it together and realize that's what took place, but then you have to ask yourself, you know, it would be a hard case to prove, I think.
Now, she did win a libel case against the original newspaper that ran the story.
Yeah.
After her baby died and she proved that was wrong.
Yeah.
Then she did win like $200,000 or something like that.
Right, but that's nothing compared to the suffering she went through in destroying her career.
Exactly. I mean, the damage was done.
I wonder in that case if it came out where the source of that material came from.
No, it didn't come out in the libel trial, no.
Yeah.
Because the person that didn't do it as a member of the FBI. They just called him up and gave him this information, and they went with it. Or maybe the guy who took it knew it was the FBI, but that was just he got these tips, so he never revealed what the source was or whatever, you know?
So all this kind of spying on its own people by the government during this COINTELPRO thing, it kind of came crashing down in the early 1970s. And the way it came to be exposed, I thought, was absolutely amazing. And there was a group called the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI. And this was an activist group, not any kind of official group or anything like that. And the only thing they're known for is they broke into a two-man Medea, Pennsylvania office at the FBI and stole over 1,000 classified documents. And then they mailed these documents to different U.S. newspapers to expose all the different FBI operations which were going on, which were violating the civil rights of American civilians. And the interesting thing is most news outlets actually refused to publish the information, saying that, well, this is ongoing operations, that if we publish this, it might hurt the lives of the agents or informants or things like that. But eventually, Washington Post affirmed that the files actually were legitimate. They ran a front page story on March 24th, 1971, and the complete collection of political documents stolen from the FBI office was published for the first time as the March 1972 issue of WIN magazine, which was a journal associated with the War Resisters League. And these documents revealed that the COINTELPRO operation had done all these different things and had been spying on people and used all this different kind of information against U.S. citizens.
The government should not be using information against U.S. citizens. They're supposed to be on our side.
Yeah. So they've analyzed these documents, or they did in the past, and according to this analysis, 1% of the files were devoted to organized crime, mostly gambling. 30% were to manuals, routine forms, and similar procedural matter. 40% were devoted to political surveillance and the like, including 2 cases involving right-wing groups, 10 concerning immigrants, and over 200 on left or liberal groups. And 14% of the documents concern draft resistance and leaving the military without government permission. And then the few other ones involved bank robberies, murder, rape, and interstate theft.
Well, that shit seems like that should be the ones they're concentrating on.
No, the ones they were concentrating on were political surveillance. It was all tied to politics and people that had different political leanings than what the FBI and what they were doing.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. The interesting thing is that the people who broke in were actually never caught. And 5 years after the break-in, the FBI closed their investigation of the burglary without ever figuring out who did it. That was after the statute of limitations had expired.
It's probably anonymous.
Well, maybe it's very similar to the beginning of it. So that's kind of telling, though, that our nation's top cops couldn't even figure who broke into their own office.
That is pretty bad. Do you think Anonymous and Banksy know each other?
I don't know. Maybe.
They might not be sure if they do.
Did you ever see that documentary, Exit Through the Gift Shop?
No.
It was the Banksy documentary?
Yeah.
It was really good.
Yeah.
Oh, you should watch it. It was really good. The people who actually broke in eventually did reveal themselves in a book that came out in 2013. And some of them were freedom riders, if you've heard of that from the 60s and the 70s.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They were involved in activism and things like that. And the interesting thing is that they had done an extensive surveillance of the FBI office. They knew exactly when the office was going to be empty. And they perpetrated the break-in on the day of the Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali's fight of the century. So they were hoping that any security guards would be glued to the radio and actually wouldn't be paying attention to it. And here's the ironic part of this entire story. Ali himself was a COINTELPRO target because of his involvement with the Nation of Islam and the anti-war movement.
Sure he was, yeah.
So basically, they were distracted watching him for his legitimate sports concern when their office was broken into.
And when they're investigating him for un-American activities.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a nice little piece of sweet revenge there, I think.
Man, that's just chasing your own tail.
Yeah. Now, people do have the ability to sue police and the FBI for different things. And generally, these are civil rights cases. So whenever the police or the FBI violate someone's civil rights. And it is actually a federal crime when a person who is acting under the color of any law, that is, a governmental authority or the pretense of any kind of authority, violates another person's civil rights willfully. And that's contained in 18 U.S. Code 242. Police brutality or other misconduct can involve violating someone's constitutional rights. And this can be for, under the 14th Amendment, depriving somebody of life, liberty, property without due process of law, or possibly unreasonable search and seizures. And the penalties for these can be pretty substantial if you violate someone's civil rights like that. And most of the stuff that was going on during this COINTELPRO I think probably would violate a lot of constitutional rights.
Absolutely.
I think it absolutely does. So when you ask, like, what is willful, because that's the word that's contained in the code, and the U.S. Supreme Court has held that the word willfully means that defendants have to have a specific intent to deprive the victim of that particular federal right. But it doesn't necessarily have to mean they were thinking in constitutional terms. They don't necessarily have to think like, I'm going to break this person's 14th Amendment rights.
Right.
They just have to know that essentially they are,
what they're doing is wrong.
Yeah. What they're doing is wrong. They're willfully doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And specific intent, we've talked about that before. That is kind of a tough standard to meet. And where that is talking about the mental purpose that you have to have a specific aim or design to accomplish something. And we've talked about that in the terms of mens rea before, and meaning the mental capacity. So whenever you're talking about someone violating someone's civil rights and doing it willfully and the police are doing that, there has to be that mental understanding that the police know what they're doing is wrong and that they're violating someone's rights.
Well, I mean, other than that, it was so commonplace for them to do it, they had to know that what they were doing was wrong.
Oh, certainly. I mean, anytime you have some sort of illegal wiretap on someone, what's the purpose of that? Because you can't use it in a court of law because it would be thrown out. It's an illegal search and seizure under the Fourth Amendment. It would be suppressed in any criminal proceeding. So the only reason you're doing that, you're violating someone's rights, knowing you're not going to use it in a criminal prosecution. Well, then why are you doing it?
It's to destroy their life. Instead of charging them with something, you're doing it to destroy their life. Now, I haven't seen it, so I'm not sure how good it is, but there was in a 2019 film on Gene Seberg. I think it was called Seberg. It was the name of it. And Kristen Stewart starred as Gene Seberg in it.
Was it Seberg, directed by Spielberg?
No, I don't think Spielberg had anything to do with it. But
that would have sounded pretty cool if you had.
It would have been. But now I haven't seen the movie, so I don't know if it's a good movie or a bad movie, but it depicts this situation that occurred in her life. So that's on my list. Yeah, I'm sure it is. That's on my list of ones that I want to watch to see how that goes. But I also didn't want to watch the movie and espouse any of that as fact, because there's some of the stuff that they put in movies to make it play better that aren't necessarily fact. So
yeah.
I tried to stick to the things that were documented.
It's like Dragnet, just the facts.
Just the facts, ma'am. Just the facts.
Well, I think that's going to bring us to
legal briefs. See, it was better last week.
It was, and you had your mouth behind your pop screen there.
Oh, I thought I was out from behind it.
No.
Oh, sorry.
I couldn't see your brief. Oh well. So, legal briefs is the part of the show, as many of you know, where I ask Tommy different legal questions that we talked about, and we see. It's like a little pop quiz, but you know it's coming.
All right, I'm ready.
Pop quiz hotshot. What does COINTELPRO actually stand for?
Counterintelligence Professional.
Program. Counterintelligence Program. Yeah. 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
Yeah, that was 66%, huh?
that's a D, maybe?
A D at a dumb school.
Now, I said most lawsuits against the FBI and police are what kind of violations?
They are 14th Amendment violations.
Right, but generally speaking, what are they?
They are bad ones. They're invasion of privacy ones.
They are generally civil rights violation type cases.
Yeah, those are bad ones.
Yes, because it is against the law and it's a federal crime if a person uses their authority under any color of law to willfully deprive someone of a constitutional civil right.
Okay.
That's bad. That's bad.
Yes. And that's usually the only thing you can get government officials on is civil rights violations.
And when I say willfully, what am I referring to?
Willfully means you knew what you were doing was wrong when you did it. It wasn't like you found out. What? They didn't tell me that. I knew it was frowned upon, but I didn't know it was actually against the rules.
And what's the legal term that I've mentioned before that the U.S. Supreme Court has defined willfully as?
I evidently wasn't listening because you just told me that a minute ago.
Specific intent.
Oh, specific intent. Okay.
Yes. It's a specific intent crime. And if it's specific intent, that means there has to be a mental capacity or mental capacity.
Mens rea.
Mens rea. Yeah, there you go. Our old friend mens rea.
Yeah.
And the actual act of it is the actus reus, which is there's two portions, the mental and the act. So, all right, well, you finished strong. That was a strong finish on the mens rea.
Well, yeah, I was a little distracted there, I think, when you were giving some of those other terms there earlier, and so I didn't. And I could hear you giving that conversation, but I couldn't remember the words.
Well, we were kind of just doing some storytelling during this episode, so I had to kind of ambush you at the end there with some different legal jargon, so it was hard to keep up.
Well, speaking of storytelling, you know who my favorite actor of all time is, right?
I do.
So it's Clint Eastwood. So
yes,
just for those that don't know. So
that was actually a subtle cue for me to inform everyone, wasn't it?
Yes, you were supposed to say Clint Eastwood.
Yeah. Yes, so Tommy.
Now Clint we know. Eastwood.
He really paints your wagon.
That's right. I love all his movies and everything. Well, when they did, when he and Gene Seberg did that Paint Your Wagon together, that was before he had hit his, you know, big numbers there with Dirty Harry and all that, Unforgiven and all those movies.
He was still doing the spaghetti westerns.
Yeah, he had just come off of those. He started out on Rawhide on TV and then did those spaghetti westerns, and that's what launched him into doing more. So he was looking for something new, different, and that's what he did, this Paint the Wagon. If you want to see something comical, really, watch this. It's a musical with Clint Eastwood. So anyway, they went to a real remote area to film this, and Clint and Gene had an affair the whole time they were filming this movie together. Both of them were married at the time. Mm-hmm. So what she didn't know is Clint was a serial philanderer. He pretty much had an affair with every lead actress he ever had in every movie. That was just the way he did. It was just an understanding he had with his wife, I think. But anyway, so one day on the set, Gene's husband turned up, and she went to him and she just confessed. As she put it, she told him, "I got a crush on someone else. Because I'm a bad liar, I had to tell Romaine about it." So that was her husband's name, Gary Romaine. So she just said she couldn't hide it. She just had to go ahead and confess it. And she also thought that she was in love with him, and thought that he was in love with her, and she thought they both were going to get divorces and run away together.
Yeah.
Well, the husband, he was outraged, and he actually challenged Clint Eastwood to a duel. Now, they never chose weapons, and it never did happen, but he actually, he challenged him to a duel. But as soon as the movie filming was over, she thought they were going to, you know, he was making arrangements and she was making arrangements, they're going to run off. He ghosted her, went away, and never had any touch with her again.
He rode off into the sunset.
Yeah, and his career took off, and of course hers just started going downhill from there. She went back to France eventually because that was the only place that she had any kind of fame at all still, or was noteworthy, because her reputation in America had been destroyed, and then ended up the way she did. And she was only 40 years old.
I saw an article talking about how she actually confessed to her husband about that and what her actual words were.
Yeah.
She said, "I'm sorry, Gary Romaine. I cheated on you, but let us move on from this together."
I got that. And then they said, and Clint said, "Make my day."
Thanks to everybody for listening. And thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable Podcast for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out, though, aren't you?
Wow, you never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Hello, and welcome to Tommy's Random Thought. Today's random thought is politics. How did we get in the situation we are in as a nation? How did our political system get so broken that nothing can get done? Neither side ever wins. I mean, one might lose, but neither wins. And we, the people that put them there, we don't ever win. Why isn't their job to make life better for all of the people of this country instead of just enriching themselves? Why do we keep putting them in power and don't ask for something different? Why do we believe that older people are more in touch with our needs and capable of negotiating a future with all the many changes and new technology advances? Our top four presidential candidates are all about 80. Look, I'm 20 years younger than them, and I'm on the back end of computer use. How do we expect these octogenarians to guide us with any kind of cognizant plan for the future? I am sure they are as lost as I am about, say, net neutrality. They'd say, call my great-granddaughter and see what she thinks. She's 12, so she will know a lot more about that than me. Thomas Jefferson had this kind of unfinished thought on having a generational restart every 19 years. He said the world should belong to the living. So when past generations leave debts or laws that later generations have to deal with, the world is being run by the dead and not the living. I have read the entire document, and I will admit I didn't understand it all, but he did make some good points. I also agree our lives should be run by the living and not the dead. I have found it is much easier to start something new than it is to change something that is established. No matter how much there is evidence that what is established may be flawed or even wrong. So, if you had one of these generational restarts, you could fix laws and conditions as they apply right now, in this day and time, and not try to change over 200 years of gospel and rulings. Maybe the idea of defunding the police would be easier to start than trying to change the decades of institutionalism and unions. Clean slate, fellows, we're going to try this now. The other part of this 19-year redo that I like is that the generation whose time it is in charge. I realize that things are a little different now, as Thomas Jefferson put the point of aging out at 34. We are living a lot longer now, so I'm not sure how all of that would work. But why should young people have to fight to overcome the laws and prejudices of the generations before, which include the dead, instead of being handed the reins and saying, good luck, I hope you do better than we did. Instead, we are turning to an 80-year-old passing his stuff on to many future generations to deal with. You hear people say they just want to make things better for their children than they had it. Why don't we want that as well for our nation? I have faith in the young people of today a lot more than I do of anyone older than me. Just think if they could implement new green technologies, new ways to eliminate systemic racism, reduce incarceration rates, and start debt-free, whether we are talking about college loan debt or the national debt. They have to swim upstream to do any of these things because of previous generations, alive and dead. It's too bad that Thomas Jefferson never finished that thought, or that John Adams, who he wrote the letter to outlining these thoughts, never took it and ran. Old Tom might have been onto something, something that would make a better future for the young and the living. This has been Tommy's Random Thought.